Hello and welcome to Brain in a Vat. This is a special episode. It's a debrief on the debate that Mark Oppenheimer and Aaron Fassett did with some Islamic scholars who came out to South Africa. It's an unusual discussion because we won't be probing a particular guest's ideas. We'll be instead probing the ideas posed by Mark and Aaron's opponents, as well as their own ideas. And we'll be discussing how the debate went and where we think it might have come off the rails and where it went well. Firstly, I should just preface this by saying that I was supposed to be part of the debate. And for the first month, Aaron and I prepared together, although Aaron did most of the preparation. And then I felt more and more uncomfortable after watching YouTube videos of our opponents. In philosophy, what we prioritize is pursuit of the truth. And philosophy, a good definition of philosophy, is the pursuit of wisdom. And it felt to me like our opponents were not, firstly, even calling them opponents would be something quite unusual for philosophers. The way it was set up was that they were there to win. And that's not something on Brain in a Vat that we would normally do. So on Brain in a Vat, we pursue the truth and we very happy to help our guests in their own views and present objections and responses on their behalf and sometimes just switch positions altogether. But the way that this was set up was a debate that needs to be won. And it was a battle between the atheists and Islamic scholars. And it felt very confrontational. And after watching a number of extremely homophobic videos that the two of them had presented on their channel, I felt very uncomfortable participating because I felt I would become very, very angry during the debate. And that's not something as a philosopher that I would ever want to do. And so Mark, I was enormously grateful, took my place in the debate. So thank you, Mark, for doing that. And he got the vitriol on the abuse instead of me. And I'm very grateful that was the case. But sorry for Mark. So I just wanted to ask first, Aaron and Mark, what the experience of the debate was like. And then after that, we can go into some detail about the arguments posed.
Yeah, sure. So I'll go first and then I'll pass it over to Mark. I echo many of your sentiments, Jason, what you said already. I mean, I take myself to be a philosopher. I've got a number of undergraduate degrees and postgraduate degrees in philosophy. And my day job is involved in argumentation all the time as an advocate, as is Marx. And I love engaging in intellectualism and ideas and the exploration of ideas for their own sake. That's very important to me, and it's part of who I am as a person. It's why I love philosophy so much, and it's why I enjoy exploring ideas, because I see ideas in some way as intellectual Lego, and you get to play with other people's Lego and build together, and hopefully you can build some nice, useful structures that actually tell you something about reality. So that was the attitude, that ethos of the search for wisdom and the search for truth is something that I take very seriously as a philosopher. And it's something that I wanted to bring to this discussion. It wasn't even supposed to be a debate. It was supposed to be a discussion. And I know that both you and I, when you were originally involved and when Mark came on, we wanted it to be framed as an academic discussion to precisely to avoid this belligerent, bellicose idea that there are views that are at war, because I don't think that is a helpful framing for the search for truth over what are very contentious issues. And after all, religious debate and religious disputation have historically been very bloodthirsty and very violent. There's a lot of that in humanity's history. And intellectualizing that is a way to completely avoid that and put that all aside and actually engage with fellow human beings in a search for truth to the discussion with. And to your question about how I felt about it, I was very disheartened with the way that things turned out. I thought that there was a huge amount of unprofessionalism on the part of our interlocutors, particularly Mohammed Hijab, perhaps less on Hamza's part. I think there must be a distinction between how they engage. I thought Hamza was more congenial, although he did interrupt and he was belligerent and condescending in his own way. And the main offender, I think, was Mohammed Hijab. So I was very disheartened with the style of communication. And that is why I, for those who have seen the debate or who have yet to see that, it got to a point in the debate where I had to make a comment on that. Because it was, to my mind, as somebody who argues in court, who is used to vehement debate with my opponents in court, with judges, both in the court, in trial courts and on appeal, we're used to vehement debate, but it's always done with a level of courtesy and respect and civility. And the same with academic discussion amongst philosophers. And I just perceived there to be, in that explicitly academic context, such a breach of etiquette and decorum that I had to say something. And unfortunately, that did have an effect on somewhat derailing our discussion and landed us in certain segues as opposed to focusing on the issues, which were the intellectual arguments, which is what we came there to discuss.
Yeah, I'll say that it's an interesting feature of practicing South African law that we are very polite. We have particular modes of address, like my learned friend. We refer to the court as my lord or my lady. You know, the way that we engage on this show is to be forceful, to present the best possible arguments, but to do so in a manner that is entirely respectful and avoids any kind of personal attack. Now, I suppose when I approached the debate, I took a couple of strategic considerations into account. The one was that the audience probably wouldn't be populated by philosophers and wasn't expecting the turnout that we had. To give you a sense of what the scale was like, and we were in one of the bigger auditoriums at the University of Johannesburg. It was completely packed to the brim, and there were four overflow rooms. I think the academics who were involved in it were completely surprised by this. And when we had a little pre-chat, we talked about, you know, what the structure of the debate would be and allowing time for audience questions. And they said, look, UJ students aren't really going to come to an event that's after hours. Don't expect much of a turnout, and don't expect much engagement. When they saw the vast numbers of people that had turned up, I think they were very overwhelmed by that. And it made me think, in particular, it's largely quite evident from the video that it's an Islamic audience who have turned out because our interlocutors have a gigantic YouTube following. And so Muhammad Hijab's channel has got almost 1 million subscribers. I think when I looked a couple of days ago, the video of the debate on their channel had about 670,000 views. If ours gets to 2,000 or 3,000, I'll be surprised. And that tells you a little bit about why we were doing different things, I think. So, and something that Muhammad has said in his analysis of the debate was, by being bellicose, by being over the top, that's how you get the numbers in. There were moments where you had these monologues that was quite strange. And a friend of mine said to me, that's form for YouTube shorts. And he was entirely right. There's a whole bunch of these spicy shorts that they posted, which basically it's Muhammad going off and then they cut to us looking. The only one that they've chopped, I think, of us is of Aaron, where there's a sense of a zinger. And it's an interesting moment where we had a lot of time pressure on us. There's also a bit that's cut from the video, about 15 minutes of this awful pinging sound. And that created this tension in the room. We then had the moderator saying, listen, you know, the poor security staff who want to leave, you know, are shivering outside. This debate has to come to an end. And Muhammad is trying to make this point and going into all sorts of historic detail that really is irrelevant. And Aaron very politely says, could you just tell me the argument? And the zinger is Muhammad pulling this face of, oh my God, I can't believe you would do that. And zoom in as his heart beats, and Hamza pulls back his very muscular arm to prevent a fist fight.
Yeah.
So my approach to think to this was to try and be as crisp and clear as I could, to use language that would be understandable by those in the room and those outside of it. So I tried to avoid as much technical jargon as I could, and to try and focus in on one particular issue. So Aaron's brief really was much, much bigger than mine. His brief was tackle Hamza's book. So he put in this enormous amount of work by reading the entire book, writing basically chapter length responses to each of the chapters in Hamza's book, all around, does God exist? My brief was, let's look at the moral question. You know, I respond to their claim for why morality requires God, which is the divine command theory. They take the view that we know what's right based on what God commands. I gave some secular alternatives. One of the sort of lines they have is atheists are required to be moral nihilists. I pointed out why that's not a requirement. It's of course compatible with atheism, but the point is that lots of things are compatible with atheism. So I gave a rights perspective and a consequences perspective and a rules perspective. And then I looked at various aspects of the Quran to say, okay, let's see what your God commands. when looking at that, I said, we must have another method to determine which one is a better moral theory. And so I came up with a sort of meta claim about what is a good moral theory. One of which is you need to know what it actually says. It must be crisp and clear. It can't be contradictory. It should largely cohere with our intuitions. It's okay for moral theories push our intuitions, but if they require you to do things that are completely outlandish, like plucking out the eyes of a newborn child, then you have reason to think, well, that's a serious defect for the theory. And so that was an evaluative tool. What came out in the debate was their line, oh, that's just white supremacy in action, that the people that you have mentioned are white men from Europe, and that's reason enough to ignore it, which is the kind of move that, you know, philosophers think very little of, but plays well to a crowd.
So it was an interesting move. The move was basically that when you say we, so our intuition, or we think that in these situations, you shouldn't string up gay people for being gay just because they're gay and murder them outright. When you say we, they took we as the hegemonic white supremacist West. And he said, we don't agree with the hegemonic white supremacist West intuition. And so you cannot make that claim. He made a similar move when Aaron said to Muhammad, I'm uncomfortable with this type of engagement. He said, don't tell me how to speak. Because what you're doing is you're enacting your cultural superiority, supposedly as a white man, and telling me how I must express my ideas. I wanted the two of you to discuss why you think this move is an ineffective move. It clearly was effective in some sense. It derailed the debate, and it was a way for them to distract from the points you were both trying to make. But why, philosophically, it's a bad move?
I think I can speak to my comment had absolutely precisely zero to do with anything, any racial or moral presuppositions. I was meta commenting on, in what I believe to be an appropriately assertive way to a style of communication that I did not sign up for in that room as academics by the, and that included the philosophy department. The philosophy department at UJ were partners in putting this together with the philosophy of religion department, as well as I understand Hamza and Muhammad's Sapiens Institute, where they is a religious a Muslim apologetics institute. In that context, I thought it was just a straightforward breach of academic and professional etiquette and civility. And it ran counter to, you'll remember, Jason, you and Mark, as part of my opening address, I quote Gyula Klima, which was a philosopher, which encapsulated what I wanted and what I understood the evening to be about. And I thought very quickly there had been a breach of that. And so it had nothing to do, my comment had nothing to do with racial superiority, ethnic superiority, intellectual superiority. I mean, it wasn't even about the arguments. It was just about back to civility so that we can reset the tone, simmer down the passions, and engage like philosophers in a collaborative exercise of truth. And that just is not what I think Mahand and Hamza are really about. I know Mark will want to speak about why this charge of Eurocentrism from an intellectual perspective doesn't stick, but I think this is an appropriate place to also just emphasize some disconcerting quotes that I noted when I watched Hamza's and Muhammad's post-debate analysis on the Muslim skeptic. So before I read some of these quotes, just to give a portrait and a picture of these gentlemen's minds and how they approached this, I want to just be fair and say that to any of our viewers who think that I might be quoting out of context, go and watch it. It's on YouTube. It's a 2.5-hour debrief between the host of the Muslim skeptic and Muhammad and Hamza. You can see the context in which they're talking to make sure that I've quoted them accurately. But for example, I'm just going to give you some examples of some of the things that they said. Muhammad says at some point about speaking about his conduct in the debate, he would rather come across as arrogant than weak. He also says in debates, the cardinal sin is to come across as weak. Hamza, in one context, says, especially in our Western ideological context, to come across as really soft, it's actually probably not the thing that is required from a hikmah, that's a wisdom perspective, because the objective of a debate is actually social engineering. It is to show that Islam is strong. Islam has intellectual veracity. Islam is not to be messed with. Yes, we're going to be nice to you, but when it comes to discussion, we're going to actually show that it's based on falsehood. Muhammad says in another context, he says, this is going back to Muhammad Hijab now, he says, we're effectively competing with films, so I have to become theatrical. I have to be entertaining. I have to bring out that side of it. He also says, I had to compensate for the lack of star power and charisma on their part, talking about Mark and myself, by being entertaining. And they should thank me for that. So that gives you a sense, a very quick sense of what their goal was. It was, by their own admission, to grandstand, to be theatrical, to present a perception that they are strong and that Islam is strong. And that is to secure and prevent any of their Muslim audience from having what are called destructive doubts. It's to enforce certainty and to secure tribal identity. And that, of course, is the complete antithesis of everything that philosophy stands for. And I think that gives you a very keen insight into what their mode and view of this entire event was. And before I hand over to Mark, this is also gives you a very keen insight into Hamza's approach, because although he was not as belligerent, overtly, and bellicose as Muhammad, I also don't think he was debating in good faith. And there's some very telling admissions in this YouTube discussion that they have. And I'm going to quote at length because our audience really needs to appreciate what is going on behind the scenes. So this is how he describes his attitude to debating with atheists. And remember, this is a philosophical, contentious, metaphysical position that has a long history. The debate about God has been going on for centuries and millennia amongst humankind. It's going on today and will undoubtedly go on in the future. So he says this. So I beg your pardon if I have to read. He says, when we sit with atheists and we have a discussion with them and we treat them as if they are intellectual equals, I don't think that this has an Islamic basis. The belief in Allah is so innate and so well confirmed by the empirical and natural world, and to even sit on a platform and assume some type of intellectual equality as if, yeah, they may have an opinion, that's an interesting point, I think that is blameworthy. He goes on to say, this is a problem. You cannot share a platform with someone who denies Allah, rejects Allah, hates Allah, doesn't believe in Allah. And you can't frame that discussion as if they may have a point, or you're standing in the possibility that they may convince you, or that they may have a strong argument. That whole psychology and framing is totally un-Islamic. We're not sitting on that platform assuming that they may have a point. They don't have a point. They will never have a point. And we're here to show them that they have an intellectual and spiritual sickness. Simple as that. To frame it otherwise comes across as a hidden form of unhealthy skepticism, which is not in line with the Islamic tradition. And I think that gives, from the horse's mouth, it tells you everything you need to know about the differences between the philosophical ethos and the apologetic ethos. Philosophy wants to follow the truth wherever it leads. Apologists think they have the truth in their back pocket, so they can't be trying to find what they think they've already got. And that is why I think this debate, in many respects, went off the rails. And the last point, I promise you before I turn it over to Mark, because I've been going on for a while, a huge epistemic double standard. Because given what I've just read about Hamza, like what he says to his own audience, he then says, without any blushing, by the way, he says, in a university context, when he's chastising Mark, he says, I want you to think that you may think that you are right, but I want you to think that there may be a possibility that you are wrong. So how's that double standard? To his own audience, he's saying, we're not wrong. We can never be wrong. These guys don't have a point. I know I'm using philosophy solely as a cudgel to prop up my view. But to my interlocutor, to everybody, when we're actually doing the debate, I want to hold them to a different standard. And I think that is disingenuous, and I think it's malafide. And it makes me skeptical that Muhammad and Hamza are ever going to actually be interested in good faith dialogue with that sort of attitude. So that's my comments just on the style of the debate and this charge, and to, so the audience can know where some of these charges are actually coming from and what they're being motivated by. So I'll just turn it over to Mark now to deal with the rest of it.
Yeah, so one of the substantive claims that I made was to say that any good moral theory is going to prohibit something like slavery. And now it is the case that throughout human history, lots of societies did engage in slavery. And the advantage of a secular moral theory is that you can say those people were wrong. They believed poor moral things. Now, the difficulty that the theist has is that if the religious text says slavery is permissible, you know, what do you got to say? You got to say, well, maybe we interpret our way around it. Maybe slavery is okay under these conditions. And so I said it's a problem for Islam that slavery is regulated. There's lots of discussion about slavery, but it's not clearly prohibited. And so instead of engaging the substantive point, what Muhammad did was to say, how dare you, as a white South African, talk about slavery when you just came out of apartheid? You basically engaged in slavery yourselves. And Islam is actually this egalitarian faith that recognizes the racial equality of all people. So how dare you, as a white person, lecture me? So you can see there's some interesting contradictions going on here. The one is, Islam really believes that all races are equal and all can become Muslim. But if you're white, shut the fuck up. So that's a sort of strange view to hold. And the other one, of course, is to hold me personally liable for the crimes of apartheid. At some point in the lecture, he says something like, oh, you're a human rights lawyer. I'm sure you would have stood up against apartheid. But the idea is, let me make it personal. Let me try and undercut your argument by, you know, raising these historical claims instead of dealing with the substance. So it's a useful distraction tactic. The one of the things that Muhammad said was, instead of dealing with my substantive complaints, some of them are, you can deal with them. So the Quran seems to think that it's okay to put to death people who are apostates, people who leave the faith, people who are blasphemers, people who engage in homosexual sex, that fornicators, those who have sex outside of marriage, should be publicly lashed. So instead of dealing with that, he said, I'm going to ask you what your proof is for objective morality, despite the fact that I'd already done it. Now, obviously, it's a deep philosophical question. You know, philosophers are going to disagree about whether there is a truth to moral realism, whether you should be skeptical about morality. My point is a simple one, is that these are different positions. There are some viable arguments for why we ought to think that morality has some kind of basis. It's not clear the theist can give a basis besides God says so and whether that gets you anywhere. But he says in his post-debate roundup, it's a tactical move. I just want to change the topic because it's very embarrassing to talk about the actual Islamic views on these things. And you see it come out in some of the discussions on the channels. If you look at their channel, as I say, enormous number of views. And basically what you have is soccer fans. So it's like, yeah, Arsenal really won. They did such a good job. They stood up to that corrupt referee, you know, and they beat the crap out of Liverpool, who are a bunch of sniveling scum. And if you look at the comments on our channel, you've got people saying, well, what's the actual argument? Let's see what the Quran really says. Does it commit you to these things? So you've got this like actual good faith engagement. One of the claims that I made on the day was there's this Quran.com has commentary on it, and it referred me to the commentary on, I think it's chapter 4, verse 16. And the commentary basically talks about all the different penalties you should have for fornicators, for homosexuals, and for people who have anal sex with a woman or sex with them while they're menstruating. And it then lists a series of penalties, and it says that should include beheading, being burnt, thrown off a building. And so I said, if I've gotten anything wrong, please let me know. Their line at the time was basically to say, this is completely preposterous. And this, you've sucked this out of nowhere. I then did further research. Quran.com gets it from this 8-volume commentary by the Grand Mufti of Pakistan, which looks, you know, all the different sutras, and was done over a period of 10 years on Pakistan radio and then produced in this volume, and makes it quite clear that this is the view of that author. Now, one of the traps that I'd laid early on was a good moral theory isn't contradictory and it tells you what you ought to do. It's not clear here what's actually being required of you. So you find there's some debate among the Islamic scholars. Do we burn people or fine them or behead them? It seems to depend. And now the difficulty, of course, is that if you're in philosophy, you go, well, what's a good idea? If you're engaged in theology, you have to go and do some archaeological research and say, What do the texts say? Which one's the good text? What does this particular school say? So you've got four different big schools in Islam, and they're going to say things that are contradictory. And so instead of engaging with that stuff, you know, their move was to try and say, well, you can't prove objective morality, so we're not going to answer your questions. They, funny enough, I think Muhammad has produced an hour-long defense of slavery, which is such a bizarre idea. As I said, like, basically every right-thinking person thinks slavery is abhorrent. That to engage in a defense of slavery, you're in a clearly weak spot. At some point, I said to them, look, we can disagree. You can hold whatever moral position you want. You just need to recognize that you're in the moral minority, that most people are going to think that there's a serious problem with that stuff. I mean, they made some bizarro claims, like there's nothing wrong with suffering. Or that evil doesn't exist. Aaron had a quickly point. Maybe when you're pumping weights in the gym and it hurts, that's suffering. And you could say that's, you know, has some kind of instrumental value to build muscle. Or when you're suffering by studying to learn a thing, you know, it has instrumental value, but surely it's not intrinsically good to suffer. A distinction which they just couldn't seem to grasp. But Aaron's right to point out that we just engaged in totally different things. And my bet with him when we first started was both sides will proclaim victory. We'll say we gave the better arguments, that our philosophical positions are much more viable. I think this was recognized by the university. The philosopher on the panel really understood Aaron's argument quite well, put it forward to Muhammad, and at some point Muhammad completely freaked out and just, you know, engaged in this attack on the moderators. So if you ask them who won, they'll say, oh, you guys did. If you ask the audience that was present, they'll say, our guys won. They stood up to you. You know, they were the valiant victor. They weren't afraid. They weren't weak. They showed the power of Islamic theology. That's an interesting thing, that it's quite hard, let's say, especially someone who's not trained in philosophy, to work out, well, who won? As soon as you're treating technical jargon, and they did tons of that. Lots of stuff that I think someone who isn't trained in philosophy would just have no idea what they were saying. But they said it with gusto. They seem very confident in their views. They're saying stuff that's supportive of the faith I already believe in. So I guess my guys won. It's why I made a point of trying to point out things that they would know, that I think I had someone come up to me immediately after from the debate saying, the worst enemy of Islam is Sharia law. He says Sharia law has no basis whatsoever. It's completely politicized. The kinds of stuff that's done in Saudi Arabia and Iran under the guise of this is what God wants is completely repugnant. He says no good person should ever think that you should do the horrible stuff that's done in these states, and was very apologetic. The first person to apologize to me was the organizer of the debate, which was from, in other words, and the organizer of the debate are the guys in South Africa who brought out Muhammad and Hamza. And I think they've
It was the local liaison. The local liaison.
I thought, in a way, what Muhammad and Hamza wanted was, we've been invited to an academic institution like university that clothes us in we're serious guys, and we're going to debate guys who have degrees in philosophy. But also, we don't want to abide by any of the good faith philosophical norms that you'd have, and we want to pack a street brawl. If you look on their channel, a lot of the critiques of Muhammad is, this is what you would do on Speaker's Corner, that you speak over your opponents, and maybe that's a useful thing to do in that setting, but it's kind of a little bit shameful to do in this setting. I think they wanted to have their cake and eat it. It's been enormously useful for them. I mean, as I said, the video has exploded. I think they monetize that stuff. You know, this is what they do for a living. You go around, you say that you go and beat up atheists in different countries, and the debates were way more viewed than the lectures they gave or the other sort of stuff that they were involved in. Having a bit of friction adds drama. We run a YouTube channel. I think it's really interesting to see how some channels have this enormous support and that you have vast numbers of people watching you. Our channel is one of the bigger philosophy channels around. I think we have a dedicated base of people who really care about philosophy, who tune in every week and want to find out what's true. But we don't have a million subscribers. And I think that's partly because not everyone has the appetite for that. It's a certain kind of engagement. It's unusual. Philosophers, I think, are strange.
When you do real philosophy, Jace, I mean, I've got up to a master's level in philosophy. Jason's done a PhD. You've also got a degree in philosophy, and you know how hard it is to do serious metaphysics, serious metaethics, serious epistemology. It's very hard because the questions that we are and the arguments that are being constructed are, at least to a lay audience, very esoteric, very recondite. They have a highly technical nomenclature that is, you know, the stock in trade for analytic philosophers, but very difficult to, when you're entering into philosophy, very difficult to wrap your head around. It's just a difficult enterprise. I think it's one of the hardest things a human being can do is engage in serious analytic philosophy. And I say that, you know, across the board. I think it's one of the hardest disciplines to do properly and to do clearly and to do justice to. And I think a lot of people see those things as barriers to entry. And I think it's easier then to just see, you know, and follow the person who's got, appears to have more charisma, who's got that thespian-like quality, who's speaking the loudest, who's speaking the most assertively and the most confidently, who's making the most grandiose assertions, and who's dominating the discussion through their body language and their demeanor. And to see that and think, ah, that's a shortcut to knowing what is true and what's right, rather than doing the hard and humble work of actually, you know, listing arguments in premises form and engaging in what this philosopher has to say about this and what this philosopher has to say about that and coming to a reasoned conclusion. It's very difficult. But I think that just goes to underscore that we were engaged in two very, very different debates. And I just want to, talk about this whole, this issue about, you know, there's a lot of commentary I've seen about us being backed into a corner and not being willing to engage in robust debate. I laugh when I read those comments because my entire life is robust debate. That is what I do, like I said, for a living. I know you do it as well. Philosophy is about robust debate. We have to ask hard questions of each other, of our own positions, of the atheist position, of a naturalistic position, but also of the religious positions and the theistic positions. So to engage in philosophical discourse in a civil way doesn't mean that we must forego probing questions. It doesn't mean that we must forego challenging. I had prepared, and you had prepared precisely for that. That is precisely why I paid Hamza the courtesy of reading the chapters in his book that were relevant to the debate, precisely so that I could prepare to engage with him and Muhammad at that level. So this idea that we were somehow scared of engaging in the debate, or the panel was there to save us, or whatever, I just think is such baloney, because we welcome that. And I know you guys welcome it on your channel on a weekly basis, that sort of discussion. And professionally, we welcome it in court, because it's the only way to find the truth. It's just that we didn't have enough time to engage with all the issues that arose, because the format was the format it was. You know, we gave our opening addresses, and then there was supposed to be that free-flowing, you know, 45 minutes discussion, which got, you know, derailed by a number of extraneous things. And we had some interlocutors who just weren't prepared to, you know, allow us sometimes a word in edgewise. So it was difficult to respond. But far be it that either of us are afraid of rigorous philosophical discussion. That's what I know we live for.
I think what's interesting is there's a few factors at play, which both of you have mentioned. One is apostasy, the idea that if a Muslim were to doubt the faith sufficiently, they should be excommunicated and possibly put to death. That raises the bar really high in terms of the stakes involved in never giving an inch to the atheist, because it could be seen as moving in that direction as apostasy. And I mean, that really shows you that there is no commitment to genuine inquiry where you can question everything. Something else.
Hamza's response to that, sorry to interrupt, Jason. Hamza's response to that, his view about engaging with atheism is that it's like engaging with a flat earth. He says as much. He said as much on Twitter. He's said as much in that discussion on Muslim Skeptic. He thinks that that's what justifies his attitude. He thinks the existence of God is so settled in his mind that to engage with somebody who denies that is like engaging with somebody who's a flat earther. And I just think that that's such a bizarre view to hold about what is clearly and obviously a contentious metaphysical question. It's one thing to say, I think I have good reasons, or I'm confident in my view, or I'm confident in my atheism and naturalism, but I still hold a space for my interlocutor to produce a good argument to say, yeah, we're debating contentious things. Here's an argument you may not have considered, that you might, Mr. Atheist or Mr. Naturalist, have to consider. And I think of that as an intellectual virtue to hold that space for my opponent, to not close down my mind to such an extent that I can't learn anything from a theist, even though I disagree.
Sure.
And I think that just shows the difference in the approaches. And I think it's for what you said, the risk of apostasy raises the stakes in some sense. And there are not just terrestrial stakes. For them, I think it's cosmic stakes. It's being condemned to the hellfire. You know, they think we're essentially agents of Satan, luring with our corrupt, secular, liberal sensibilities and atheistic sensibilities, doing the work of Satan and luring people with cookie crumbs into the furnaces of hell. And I think that's the image that they have in their mind. You know, it's very difficult to then have a good faith discussion with somebody like that who just sees you as, Hamza says, spiritually and intellectually corrupt. Then what do you do with that? Where do you go? What room is there for dialogue when, if that's the starting point and the alpha and the omega of their position intellectually? I don't know what to do with that.
I think it's interesting that as philosophers, we spend an enormous amount of time analyzing our positions, analyzing our opponents' positions, analyzing objections to our positions, trying to respond to them. And after many years of study and writing and publishing and debate, we come to a conclusion that we're quite confident in. And yet philosophers have reached a point where they're very, very humble in that expression. And one of my favorite shows that we've had, one of our favorite guests that we've had on our show, is Graham Oppie, who is an atheist, who's one of the most humble people we've had on our show. And he is immensely knowledgeable and has very good rebuttals to any of these arguments that Hamza and Mohammed raised. And yet when you hear him speak, it's a very different delivery style to especially Mohammed's. Being in the room there, it's not something you really capture on the video or the audio. Mohammed speaks incredibly loudly and he puffs out his chest and he's an unbelievable orator. It's the style of delivery is incredibly powerful. And the human in me just wants to believe what he says, because there's some evolutionary programmed mechanism in me as just as a human being that wants to trust a leader with that amount of charisma. And that goes a long way when, as you say, Aaron, there's arguments raised are actually very difficult to dissect and argue about one way or the other. There's enormous complexity and nuance to a lot of the claims that are made. And he would just gloss over a lot of that. But there are responses to each of the objections he makes. But when it's delivered in that style, that's so charismatic and that's so well delivered.
Self-assured.
Yeah, yeah.
And self-assured.
Enormous confidence, massive. You want to believe him. And you can understand, especially if you're looking at average IQs in societies where most people are not geniuses. Most people are not capable of analyzing arguments with great precision, that it's just easier to go along with the louder, better presented position. And I'm not trying to criticize either of you in terms of the way you presented as philosophers would. You presented with humility. You both said during both of your deliveries, if I got anything wrong about Islam, please let me know. I promise you they didn't say, if we got anything wrong about the atheist position, please let us know. You both presented with the humility that a Graham Oppie would. You both presented with the intellectual comfort and humility and confidence that an academic is trained to present with. But that doesn't stand up in the court of popular opinion to this incredibly powerful, high-stakes delivery where if you give an inch, you're going to go to hell. It really changes the battlefield. I wanted to raise some interesting questions around the typical moves that they made. We've discussed one so far, which is this move that you cannot tell us what's right or wrong according to your white Eurocentric intuitions, or you cannot tell me how to speak as a white man. But there were other moves made, which neither of you had a chance to rebut. One of them was that if you look at any of the arguments around morality, around the physical world, it couldn't have been the case that the physical world arose. It couldn't have been the case that morality arose out of nothing. You can't have something coming out of nothing. And what the atheist proclaiming is absurd. The atheist is assuming that all the things we see around us, morality, and in Hamza's argument, rationality, all came from nothing, and that's impossible. They couldn't have arisen out of nothing. Given now that you have a chance to respond to that without someone interrupting you, without someone shouting at you, how would you respond? Mark, you can start with, how would you respond to the claim that morality couldn't have come from nothing, and atheists are assuming that?
Yes. So I think that there's a couple of different ways of thinking about where morality emanates from. One line is to say that given that beings have a capacity to suffer, that that's a felt thing, that it's the kind of thing that people try and avoid, that animals will try and avoid it, humans will try and avoid it, that that gives us a reason not to perform acts that inflict suffering on other people. That's one basis for it. So you can say, given the nature of what we are as beings, that morality sort of supervenes on that. The other one is that Kantian approach, where you can say, given that we have the capacity for reason, we can generate rules. And so you can use a categorical imperative to determine what you're entitled to do. The third was a Rawlsian case, which I think is the most easy as a layperson to think about. So the case that I give in the debate briefly is, imagine that you wake up in a hospital bed, and you're covered head to toe in bandages, and you have a severe case of amnesia. You don't know your age, your race, your sex, but you have a basic idea about human psychology and economics. Doctor walks into the room and he says, I'm going to give you a once in a lifetime opportunity, which is you can set the rules for the world that you're about to enter into, but you've got to set the rules before I take the bandages off. And so you think to yourself, well, I could have a rule, which is that men get all the nice jobs, but what if I'm a woman? What if I have a rule that black people are only allowed to live in certain areas of the country? What if I'm black? So out of self-interest, you have a reason to produce rules that are egalitarian in nature. And so Rawls uses that veil of ignorance to generate common sense morality quite well. And I think that's a good basis to say that you can have these moral norms. Now, we're going to have Matt Lutz and Spencer Case on the show later this year to talk about this big topic of moral realism or moral skepticism. And I think that there's some pretty good arguments on both sides. And you know, they've written this debate book with utmost humility to say, well, maybe my opponent has a point. Maybe it's quite hard to come up with a good grounding for morality. It's not clear to me that the theist has one. So
exactly. It's a sword that cuts both ways.
Yeah. So if you're going to say, explain to me why suffering is bad, you're going to really attack a sort of fundamental thing, or why there are these things like human rights. Sometimes at some point says, you know, you're assuming that the UN Charter of Human Rights is a good thing. You know, and he says culturally loaded. Well, it's not clear that the theist has a good answer, right? So the theist can go, oh, God says so therefore we have to do it. Okay. And why? So God says, go and kill your firstborn. Why would that make it moral? Just because God said so. It seems like you want some other kind of basis. And it's not clear that they can give you a good one. The other one is God says so because he knows what's good. So it's not his mere commanding of it that makes it good. It's that he's got this divine wisdom. But if he knows what's good, that implies that morality has some kind of separate basis, which is grounded separately from God's existence. He just has this knowledge about it. So then you're in the same position as the atheist who says there's second morality. So it's a sort of dangerous move for them to say, well, morality has no basis. You'll see in a lot of the comments, there's this subjectivist, objectivist debate stuff that's, I don't know, a little bit puerile, I thought.
Yeah. So, I mean, on this point, I think just focus for a moment on their divine command ethics. Because I think you're absolutely right, Mark. And obviously, what you're laying out is essentially Euthyphro dilemma, which is the standard response to any form of divine command theory. And then the one horn is what the meta-ethicist David Brink calls the voluntarist horn, which leads to the arbitrariness problem that you spoke of. And the other one is he actually calls in his paper on this issue, he calls it naturalism. But we can call it he just means the autonomy of ethics, that ethics is in some sense ontologically independent of God and states of affairs involving God. And he makes the point, he says, look, if you go for the voluntarist horn and your concern is objectivity, well, voluntarism is just subjectivity writ large, right? It's just the opinion of God that X or Y or Z is wrong, or A or B or C is morally permissible. So voluntarism is just ethical subjectivism at the grandest scale, right? So you don't get objectivity in that way. You know, ethical subjectivism in the literature is defined as the thesis that moral judgments express moral propositions. Those moral propositions are truth apt. They're the sorts of things that can be true or false. And that the truth makers and only truth makers for our basic moral judgments are the doxastic attitudes or the doxastic commitments of an individual or a society of individuals. If you take the voluntarist horn that's ethical subjectivism, just with God playing the role of the individual. If you take the autonomy of ethics horn, well, then the jig is up, right? Because then you're saying God plays no essential role in the grounding of any of our basic moral propositions. Now, their response and the response in the literature, which Mark addressed in the debate, was that the response from theists is that this is a false dilemma. So they accuse the Euthyphro dilemma of being a false dilemma. And they say that there's a third option. And what that third option is a form of modified divine command theory coupled with what I call a divine aretaic theory. And what do I mean by aretaic? I mean of and relating to virtue. So in other words, what they do is they combine divine command theory and say God's commands are the source of moral obligation. But God's moral obligations are not arbitrary because they flow necessarily from his character. And his character is something like the personification of Plato's good, right? So it's a, God's character is a kind of concrete Platonic form that encapsulates the good. So there's a theoretical identification between God's character and the good, right? So axiology is sourced in God, and his commands to us necessarily and essentially reflect that character. This is supposed to, so its proponents contend, navigate between the Scylla and the Charybdis of these two horns that we've spoken about. And Mark's point and my point, and it's a point of numerous philosophers, one of the best philosophers who's written on why this is not a good response is the philosopher Wes Morriston. So any of our listeners who want to go read more about this particular response by theists should read Wes Morriston's articles, because he does a good job analyzing why this is not a good response. The central point he makes is that if you equate God's nature with the good, right, then it seems that what you're saying is that God has certain properties. He has the property of being loving. He has the property of being just. He has the property of being merciful. He has all these wonderful constellation of properties that constitute his character. Right? That's how we understand what it is to have a character. We talk about a vicious person or a vicious character and a virtuous character, and we cash that out in terms of properties. But if you do that in order to give your claim content about what the good is, then it seems that what's doing the moral work are the properties. And so, as Mark pointed out, the dilemma is not sidestepped. It's merely pushed to the level. The focus of inquiry is now God's properties. What is it about the properties that makes these constellation of properties the axiologically positive properties? So the dilemma arises again. Is God's character good because he's loving, just, kind, and so on? Or are those properties good-making properties simply because God happens to have those properties? If you take the view that God is good because of those properties, well, then you're saying it's love that makes God good. It's kindness and generosity and justice that makes God good. We may be lucky, finite creatures that we are, that there is a being that perfectly exemplifies those properties. Whew, lucky us. God, but those properties would be good even if God didn't instantiate them. If Mark, I, or you, or any one of the billions of sentient creatures on this planet evince those character traits are good because of what they are, the intrinsic nature of those properties. On the other hand, if you take the other horn and you say, well, no, the goodness of those properties is cashed out solely and exclusively because God, this person over here, has them, and they're good only because he has them, that just seems absurd, right? Because suppose God had properties that were the antithesis of what we think of as moral properties. So suppose God was vicious and cruel and capricious and stingy and all of these things that we would normally associate with a vicious character. If God had those, they would be good. Why? Because God would instantiate those properties. So the horns of arbitrariness and autonomy arise again at the level of properties. And I don't think that point has been seriously appreciated by Hamza or Muhammad. Certainly in Hamza's book, when he raises this third option, he doesn't deal with this challenge to his view. And I think that that is something that is just unacknowledged by our interlocutors in the debate. And it's something that I don't think that they've applied their mind properly to.
So the two of you have done a good job propping up the case that the atheist can give, if he wants to, an objective reason for why moral facts are the way they are, and that, ironically, the theist can't, at least by only citing God. The theist would have to cite the same principles that the atheist cites in order to support the objective nature or the rationality of morality. I think there's also another throwaway line that's related that Hamza often uses and Muhammad often uses, which is the world could not have always been there. It is impossible that the world could have existed infinitely. That is absurd. And so there had to have been a beginning, but that beginning couldn't have come from nothing. It must have come from something. And that something therefore had to have been God. How would you deal with that argument?
Yeah, I don't mind taking the lead on this because I prepped on this. It's an issue that comes up in two places philosophically. It comes up in cosmological arguments, which are usually causation arguments, which appeal to a sequence of causes and then attempts to argue that there must be a first cause or a first mover, and then identifies that first mover with God. And it also comes up in contingency arguments, which classically trade in modal concepts, like possibility and necessity, which philosophers are very, working in the field of metaphysics and modal logic, are familiar with, but which a lay audience might not be familiar with. One of the problems I have with Muhammad's presentation of his, what he calls a contingency or dependency argument, is that he actually runs a whole bunch of different things together in his argument. So it's called a contingency argument, but generally, strictly speaking, contingency arguments trade on modal concepts. They don't trade in non-modal concepts like causal sequences or chains of dependency. They trade on the fact that even if you had, whether it be a finite causal chain or an infinite causal chain, there's still, according to some form of the principle of sufficient reason, there has to be an explanation for that infinite chain, or there has to be an explanation for the finite chain. So once you make that move to the principle of sufficient reason, regardless of whether you embrace causal finitism, the idea that their causal sequences terminate with an absolute beginning in the natural world, or an infinite causal chain that goes on forever, once you make the move to the principle of sufficient reason and you're talking the language of possible existences or things that must exist, now you've moved into the realm of contingency arguments. If you're talking about causation and whether causal finitism is true or causal infinitism is true, you're generally speaking in the realm of something like the Kalan cosmological argument. So the first thing to point out is that the atheist or the naturalist has a number of options, right? So the atheist doesn't have to be committed to the idea that the universe, I'm just going to talk now about cosmological arguments and then go to the contingency argument. So when it comes to something like the Kalam cosmological argument, which runs that everything that begins to exist has a cause, the universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause, the naturalist has a number of options. The naturalist can think, he can embrace causal finitism, but think that the first item, the first causal item, is the first state of the universe. And that first state of the universe exists a se, that is to say, independently of any other ontological item or any other state. What the modal status of that initial segment of natural reality is a different question, right? It may be a brute contingency or it may exist of necessity. This is something that Graham Oppie, who you've mentioned and you've had on your, I can construct a view, a naturalistic picture where natural reality has an initial state. That state exists, there's no room to talk about causes of the global causal order. And because the naturalist thinks that the global causal order is just exhausted by the natural causal order, it makes no sense to talk about the cause of the initial natural state. And so there is a first item. It exists independently, which is to say it is not, it doesn't owe its ontological existence to anything else that exists. And it is the start of the causal chain. So you can embrace causal finitism as a naturalist without thinking that the universe popped into being out of nothing. We're not committed to that. But there are people, there are naturalists and atheists who think that we don't have to even accept causal finitism, that we can embrace infinite causal chains. And to take that move is you're going to start moving in the direction of the literature, which tries to argue for and against the possibility or the absurdity or non-absurdity, depending on which side you take, of infinite causal chains or infinite series or infinite actual infinities in reality. There's various ways of putting it. And the atheist can also embrace causal chains. I don't see definitive arguments in the literature that I'm familiar with that put it beyond reasonable doubt that infinite causal chains are logically impossible or metaphysically impossible. And we heard nothing in the debate, actually. If people go and listen carefully, he makes assertions that infinite causal chains are absurd. And he says, because it would imply that the inexhaustible had been exhausted. He doesn't explain what he means by that. It would imply, he says, that you could have infinite sets within infinite sets. And he doesn't explain why that would be intellectually opprobrious to adopt that view. And we can go into more detail here about the responses to that, but it does get technical, and we have to start looking at things like the differences between transfinite sets and infinite sets and finite sets. And they are just different principles that apply to these things that mathematicians and metaphysicians who work in this field are aware of. And he doesn't anywhere in his presentation in the debate, and Hamza certainly doesn't in his book when he deals with similar material, engage with any of that material. The point that I'm trying to make here in brief, without going into too much technical jargon, is that the naturalist or the atheist has options. We don't have to be committed. Okay. To any atheists listening, don't let metaphysical bullies tell you that you have to be committed to all of reality, popping into existence ex nihilo. Okay. It's not something that an atheist has to be committed to. You can believe that there are finite causal chains and think that the first moment of natural reality exists, I say. Maybe you then think that exists of brute contingency or it exists of necessity. That's a separate question. You can also think that there are infinite causal chains. I don't think that those have been philosophically ruled out in the literature. So there are options on that score. Turning then to the contingency point, there I think I want to just say two things. First, like I said, Muhammad's argument seems to my mind when I listen to it. It's very difficult because he never puts it in premise form in any of his presentations, which makes it very difficult to actually understand what the main argument is and what sub-arguments are for the premises. So it makes it a bit challenging. But I think he conflates modal and non-modal concepts. So what does this mean? Modal concepts are concepts of necessity and possibility. What do philosophers mean by X exists, contingently and exists of necessity? It exists in what philosophers call every possible world. Something exists contingently if it exists at least one possible world. Now, possible world semantics are the ways that most philosophers have gone about explicating the notions of necessity and contingency. So they're about what happens in these maximally consistent sets that we call logically possible worlds. And something exists of necessity if you think of logical possible worlds horizontally, they're all laid out horizontally, something would exist of necessity if it's a member of each one of those possible worlds. Something would exist contingently if it only exists in one or some of those possible worlds. Now, philosophers distinguish that, which is a true contingency arguments trade in those concepts, from other concepts which are non-modal in nature. So things like dependence and independence. So for example, within a possible world, you can have chains of dependence. And you might have an item that exists independently in one possible world, right? Which is simply to say it doesn't depend on anything else in that possible world, without that thing existing across all possible worlds. And I don't think that Hamza makes that distinction. I think he conflates necessity and independence. Another way of seeing why he conflates this, and this comes from the metaphysician Peter van Inwagen in his book Metaphysics. Peter van Inwagen has no problem making the distinction between dependence, dependence and independence and necessity and contingency, and not conflating an independently existing thing with a necessarily existing thing. And he says, suppose A is necessary and exists in every possible world. And suppose further that it's necessary that A wills B. Well, then it turns out B is dependent on A. But B exists in every possible world because A exists in every possible world and necessarily wills that B exists. So B is a necessarily existing thing, but it's dependent. And I think these distinctions are just conflated willy-nilly in his presentation of his argument, which makes it challenging to unpack. The idea is that the naturalist must either be committed to the universe being brutally contingent, or he must accept that the universe exists of necessity. If he thinks that the universe, the entirety of the universe exists of necessity, then it entails a rather unpalatable consequence called modal collapse, which violates a whole host of pre-theoretic intuitions we have about the contingency of certain things. So that doesn't seem very attractive. And then the idea is that if you think of the whole universe, the whole of natural reality as being the big contingent fact, whether it's constituted by a finite chain or an infinite chain, whatever the story is there, then the idea is that if you're committed and you think the principle of sufficient reason is true, then that big contingent fact needs an explanation. And then you need to be committed to a necessary being. And he thinks that the atheist can't do that because that leads to problems for the atheist. But there's two responses to that. One is we can deny the principle of sufficient reason, and we can talk more about that a bit later. So many atheists just think that there can be brute contingencies and the universe can be a brute contingency. And there are many atheist philosophers who take that route. Other atheist philosophers don't feel the need to take that route. Graham Oppy, for one, says that if you held his feet to the fire, he would not go that contingency route. He would embrace a view that says that there is a necessary component to reality. And then there's a contingent component to natural reality. So the naturalist, again, doesn't have to be committed to the universe being entirely necessary or entirely contingent. They can believe that there's an initial part, say, that exists, are, say, and is necessary. And then that subsequent stages are contingent. And that contingency is grounded in the outworking of objective chance. So in other words, that initial state evolves in an aleatory and objectively chancy nature. And that's what accounts for contingent items in the world or contingent states of affairs. But there's still a necessary aspect of reality, which is that initial part. So there's just a false dilemma that is being foisted on the atheist and the naturalist in that contingency argument. And we can unpack some of that further, but I just wanted to give some of the major responses that can be made to that argument.
I'll just add one short thing to that, which is, let's assume that there was a creator who puts the wheels in motion. That doesn't get you the divine God. It doesn't get you a being worthy of worship. It doesn't get you a being that still exists. It might be that you had a creator who was the uncaused caused, put the universe into motion, and then did other things, stop looking at it, or cease to exist. So yeah, it only gets you a very limited account of what God could be. And one of the things that Aaron does very well in the debate is start off by saying, let me tell you what a conception of God is, which is that it's the creator, it's the sustainer, it's everlasting, it's all good, all powerful, all knowing. Once you have that beefed up version of God, Hamza's argument about, you know, something can't come from nothing doesn't get you very much. It gets you maybe this, the creator pops into existence, but it definitely doesn't give you Allah. So I thought that was an important point for Aaron to make up front, and one they never really engaged with.
We didn't even have a chance to go into that, really. I mean, what you're referring to, Mark, and it's what I referred to and I was prepared on to take them to task on in my briefs, was it's what's known in the literature as the gap problem. So it's precisely the problem of, even if you grant the premises of the argument, the conclusion of at least of those first stages of those arguments is very anemic. It doesn't get you God. It gets you a cause of the universe, or it gets you a necessarily existing entity. You have to do a lot more philosophical work in what are called stage two arguments to get from that thin or anemic conclusion to the full-blooded, fully orbed conception of God, which is what Muslims and Christians and Jews and theists generally believe in. And so there's just this equivocation with this notion of God. Muhammad thinks that he gets to this conclusion and that he's demonstrated God exists, but he hasn't demonstrated that. He hasn't shown all the omni attributes. He hasn't shown, like Marx said, a number of the other divine attributes that are thought to be essential to God. That argument doesn't get you to God. It gets you to something that's like God, but not God. And that's even if you grant charitably all the premises, which of course neither of us do. And it's sufficiently well known, like I said, in the literature to have its own name. It's called the gap problem. And it's notoriously difficult to get from those very modest, mild, thin conclusions to that fully orbed conception of God. And those stages of the arguments are often, if we're talking about relative strength in terms of persuasiveness, they are often much weaker than the first stage to get to that anemic conclusion to begin with. So I would just advise people who want to look more into those arguments to just know that there are usually two stages to those arguments. And the stage two is designed to bridge the gap, so to speak.
Both of you for taking the time to explain what it was like to be in the debate, to explain the problems with some of the moves that Muhammad and Hamza made. And in the careful, methodical light of philosophy to explain the arguments in fuller form. And yeah, thank you both for firstly taking my place, Mark. It was enormously helpful, and Aaron for your enormous amount of preparation. And I thought you both won the debate, if there was a winning of anything. And secondly, answered your profession very well. So thank you both, and thank you everyone to listening to this episode.